Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 37. Hi, I'm Jake, and co-host Nikki has the week off. I'm going to bring you a brief episode with this week's historical anniversaries, then we'll be back next time with an episode about organized crime in Boston. So without further ado, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history. Monday is July 17th. Starting in 1820, the Missouri Compromise preserved a delicate balance between slave and free states in the U.S., ensuring that a new free state was admitted to the Union for every new slave state. It also held that the remainder of the Louisiana Purchase, territory that would include the future states of Kansas and Nebraska, would not allow slavery. In the spring of 1854, Congress passed a law that upended this balance. The Kansas-Nebraska Act organized territory that would soon become two new states, and it said that the issue of slavery in these new states would be decided by their voters at the time they were admitted to the Union. That means that the new states had the potential to swing the balance of power nationally firmly in favor of slave power. After the bill passed, pro-slavery settlers streamed over the border from Missouri into the new Kansas Territory. Soon, violence broke out between abolitionists and slavers in a low-level civil war that would come to be known as Bleeding Kansas. In an effort to counter the power of slaveholders who moved into Kansas Territory from Missouri, Eli Thayer of Minden, Massachusetts, formed a group called the Immigrant Aid Company. That's immigrant with an E. The company was formed to support and promote settlers moving from New England to Kansas, with the express goal of getting Kansas admitted as a free state. Along with recruiting settlers, the company would provide hotels for them along their journey, local land agents, sawmills, and other infrastructure developments. The first party of Emigrant Aid Company settlers left Boston on July 17, 1854. It consisted of 29 men, and they arrived in Kansas City on July 29th. Some of those men would go back east. Others would bring their families and settle down in Kansas permanently. They founded towns such as Manhattan, Lawrence, and Topeka, Kansas. Many of the true believers would go on to serve in the Union Army. One was imprisoned in 1856 for helping enslaved Kansans escape. On July 18, 1776, Boston residents heard the Declaration of Independence for the first time, when it was read aloud from the balcony of the old State House. Abigail Adams related the experience in a letter to John. "Last Thursday, after hearing a very good sermon, I went with the multitude into King Street to hear the Proclamation for Independence read and proclaimed. Some field pieces with the train were brought there, the troops appeared under arms, and all the inhabitants assembled there. When Colonel Crafts read from the balcony of the State House the proclamation, great attention was given to every word. As soon as he ended, the cry from the balcony was, 'God save our American states,' and then three cheers which rended the air. The bells rang, the privateers fired, the forts and batteries, the cannon were discharged, the platoons followed, and every face appeared joyful. After dinner, the king's arms were taken down from the State House and every vestige of him from every place in which it appeared, and burnt in King Street. Thus ends royal authority in this state, and all the people shall say, Amen." This event is commemorated every year when the declaration is proclaimed from the balcony of the old State House on the morning of the 4th. Wednesday is July 19th, and on July 19th, 2013, the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office made a shocking announcement about the Boston Strangler. Over the decades after Strangler suspect Albert DeSalvo's death, many people around Boston, including your humble hosts, had come to doubt the accepted wisdom that DeSalvo was the Strangler. He recanted his confession, the jailhouse snitch who had tied him to the Strangler killings was a dubious source, and there was never any hard evidence. Remember that Albert DeSalvo was convicted of unrelated crimes, and nobody was ever tried for the Strangler murders. Finally, in 2013, the DA believed that DNA sequencing technology had improved enough to allow them to DNA test seminal fluid that was found at the site of the Strangler's last murder. First, they had to establish a link to the DeSalvo family, so Boston police secretly followed one of Albert DeSalvo's nephews until he threw away a water bottle. They were able to retrieve his DNA from the bottle and prove that there was a link between male DeSalvos and the evidence found at the 1964 murder scene. Next, a court ordered that Albert DeSalvo's body should be exhumed and DNA tested. His DNA was a match against the nearly 50-year-old samples from the victim's apartment. As law enforcement officials announced, "Specifically, DNA specialists calculated that the odds that a white male other than DeSalvo contributed the crime scene evidence at 1 in 220 billion. At the time Sullivan was killed, only about 3.2 billion human beings were alive on the planet, and only about 107 billion human beings have ever lived on the planet." Case closed. General William Heath wrote to George Washington to brag about his men who had attacked and burned Boston Light on July 20, 1775. At the time, the British had control of Boston Harbor, and the lighthouse, which had been built in 1716 and is now the nation's oldest, was a strategic asset for them. "Sir, I have the pleasure to inform Your Excellency that Major Vose of my own regiment, besides securing the barley on Nantasket, yesterday morning landed on the Lighthouse Island with 6 or 7 boats. The lighthouse was set on fire and the woodwork burnt. The party brought off 3 casks of oil, all the furniture of the lighthouse, about 50 weight of gunpowder, and a quantity of cordage. Of course, the British were able to repair the lighthouse by the end of the month, but the Patriots then attacked and burned it again, just days later. Finally, the retreating British Navy would blow up Boston Light the following summer. Friday is July 21st. When Pumpsy Green took the field for the Red Sox on July 21st, 1959 as a pinch runner, Jackie Robinson had already been retired from baseball for 2 years. Every other Major League Baseball team had at least one black player. The Phillies, last of the National League holdouts, had signed John Kennedy in 1957. No, not that John Kennedy. The Detroit Tigers, the last MLB team without an African-American player, called up Ozzie Virgil in 1958. That left the Red Sox, who had a troubled history with race. A year earlier, the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination confronted the organization with the fact that they did not employ a single African-American. From the players on the field, to the groundskeepers and janitors at Fenway Park, to the front office secretaries, every employee of the Sox organization was white. The team had passed on Jackie Robinson, and the scout who went to look at Willie Mays gave up after rain delays, saying, "I'm not going to waste my time waiting on a bunch of N-words." After Pumpsy Green finally broke the color barrier for the Red Sox, many people felt that there really wasn't anything to celebrate. As ESPN put it years later, "When your organization is less interested in Willie Mays than a spell of bad weather, you get Pumpsy Green. When you have the jump on Billy Williams and he gets away, you get Pumpsy Green. When your top baseball man patronizes Jackie Robinson, you get Pumpsy Green. When you're one of the richest teams in the game and fail to capitalize for more than a decade on a pool of the most talented, available, and economically desirable ballplayers in the history of the game, you get Pumpsy Green. When the state's corporate watchdog sues your organization not once but twice for discriminatory hiring practices, you get Pumpsy Green. In short, you get trivia over what could have been a triumph." Next time you're walking through Boston's North End, stroll through North Square, past the Paul Revere House, and continue down Garden Court Street. It's a tiny, narrow, dark little lane, but if you keep your eyes peeled, you'll see a small brass plaque marking the site of Rose Fitzgerald's birth on July 22, 1890. Rose's father was John "Honey" Fitz Fitzgerald, a popular politician and the son of Irish immigrants. By the time Rose turned 5, her father had been elected to Congress. By the time she was 15, he was the city's first Irish-American mayor. Her high school graduation was front-page news, and her famous father was photographed handing her the diploma. Rose Fitzgerald was accepted to Wellesley College, but instead, she went to a convent school at Honey Fitz's request. When she was 90 years old, reminiscing about a long, full life with biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin, she would say, "My greatest regret is not having gone to Wellesley College. It's something I have felt a little sad about all my life." In 1914, she married businessman and Democratic Party operative Joseph Kennedy, and they bought a house in Brookline. It would become the birthplace of one of America's most influential political dynasties, which would include Joe Kennedy Jr., Bobby Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, and of course John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who was named after his grandfather, Honey Fitz. After serving in World War II, John Kennedy would get his start in politics by running for and winning the congressional seat that had been Honey Fitz's first public office as well. Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy lived to be 104 years old, through a life that was touched by more tragedy than any one family should bear. But in her 1974 autobiography, she would write, "There have been times when I felt I was one of the most fortunate people in the world, almost as if providence or fate or destiny, as you like, had chosen me for special favors." I was fortunate enough to meet Rose Kennedy briefly in Hyannisport in the early 1990s, not long before her death. Finally, Sunday is July 23rd, and on July 23rd, 1715, the Great and General Court of Massachusetts passed a law known as "An Act for Building and Maintaining a Lighthouse upon the Great Brewster, called Beacon Island, at the entrance of the harbor of Boston." Whereas, the one of a lighthouse at the entrance of the harbor of Boston hath been a great discouragement to navigation by the loss of the lives and estates of several of His Majesty's subjects. For prevention whereof, be it enacted by His Excellency the Governor, Council, and Representatives in General Court assembled, and by the authority of the same, that there be a lighthouse erected at the charge of the province on the southernmost part of the Great Brewster, called Beacon Island, to be kept lighted from sunsetting to sunrising. The lighthouse was completed the following year, and celebrated its 300th anniversary last summer. Though as you heard earlier, it did get slightly burned down and blown up during the Revolution. Your humble hosts highly recommend a visit to Boston Light as one of Boston's can't-miss historic and scenic activities. If you'd like to learn more about any of the historic events I discussed this week, check out the show notes at hubhistory.com/037. We'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. If you'd like to get in touch with us, email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. I know we say it every week, but we really do appreciate your reviews on Apple Podcasts. That one app is responsible for well over 50% of all podcast downloads worldwide. And Apple heavily weights reviews when deciding what podcasts to surface. So your review really is the best way to help others discover this show. That's all for now. We'll be back next time with an episode on organized crime in Boston by listener request.